Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs nor condemns people for being involved in drugs. To the extent that drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when people who use drugs are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized. In 2011, in the journal Critical Public Health, Dr. Catherine McLean wrote, quote, "By the end of 1991, needle exchange was offered in a small handful of cities across the U.S., in Portland, Tacoma, San Francisco, and occasionally New York, New Haven, Philadelphia, and Boston. Only Portland's privately financed exchange had achieved clear, albeit limited, legality." End quote. That's history, because nowadays, of course, there are syringe service programs in operation all over the U.S. Many operate with the full legal backing of their state and local governments. Some don't. At the federal level, it's murky at best. Our federal public health authorities all endorse syringe exchange, yet syringe service programs are prohibited from using federal funds to buy syringes because of Congress. We have made a lot of progress over the years. We still have a long way to go, but we have made a lot of progress. The point I'm trying to make is that real progressive changes don't trickle down from the top. The legal revolution, which is harm reduction and drug policy reform, has always been preceded by popular cultural evolution. It's trickle up, and government is always playing catch up. When change does happen, it starts at the local level, and then it pushes upward as we seek approval from higher and higher authorities. Now, recently, we've been watching this process happen in real time up in Canada, where several cities are seeking permission from their federal government to decriminalize simple possession locally. The cities are acting because they're tired of waiting for their provincial governments or federal government to act. The cities are only doing this because harm reduction activists and advocates for people who use drugs, people like the Drug User Liberation Front and Moms Stop the Harm, are forcing the issue. On the other side of the Atlantic, in the UK, harm reduction activists and advocates are making some real progress. We've discussed previously some of the reforms that Scotland is implementing. The Scottish national government has been making real headway, though they are limited in what can be done because Scotland is still part of the United Kingdom. Well, now London is starting to look at what can be done to save lives, what they can do by acting locally. The London Assembly's Health Committee held an information gathering session on October 15th to look into overdose prevention and harm reduction interventions. We're going to hear portions of that session on today's show. Let's hear part of their discussion on drug safety testing. Steve Rolls is a senior policy analyst with Transform.
There's not a single type of drug checking. There are a number of different types of service that can exist that serve different needs and different populations of users. I'm speaking on behalf of The Loop, who began their work in 2013 working behind the scenes with police and Home Office, testing drugs that were provided from amnesty bins or from police seizures. As more of a sort of research to sort of analyse drug markets and on occasion provide information to emergency service and service providers about certain drugs of concern that were within markets. In 2016, that changed when they did their first drug checking service at a festival, in fact, two festivals that summer, Secret Garden Party and Kendall Calling. And what happens in that context is that individuals can bring a substance of concern. They will drop it off in a locked box and get a sort of ticket number. And then after a given period of time, between an hour, a half an hour, or sometimes a little bit longer, depending on the testing that's needed, they can come back and they can receive the results of the testing. And a condition of receiving those results is that they also have this brief intervention with a trained counsellor who will give them health and harm reduction advice tailored for their particular needs in terms of the individual, the type of behaviours that they're reporting that they're engaging in, and the drug testing result. The testing is done by volunteers, but they're all PhD level chemists, and the interventions are delivered again by volunteers, but they're all trained drug counsellors. The testing involves a range of technologies, including FTIR, laser, Bruker analysis machines. There is a range of different technologies available, and it will depend on the particular setup. But generally, for the loop, as a minimum, they use these laser FTIR machines. They basically shine a light through the drug. A particular kind of pattern of light refraction is then interpreted and related to a database of over 3,000 different drugs, so that whatever drug is in the sample can be identified, and if there are multiple drugs in the sample, that can also be identified. It's very clever technology. As new drugs are discovered, they will be added to the database. So things like, you know, emerging NPS, for example, when they're identified, they'll be added to the database. That's the basic setup, but that is really the model that would happen at festivals, for example, or events. You can also have drug testing as part of a drug service provider. So a drug service provider that deals more with problematic users or people who are street drug users could access the service to test drugs before they inject or smoke them, for example. And in some places, a drug checking service is available as part of a drug consumption facility, supervised drug consumption facility. I know that's something we're going to be talking about later. But drug checking and drug consumption facilities often go together. So I visited one in Copenhagen, for example, where there is a supervised injecting facility, but it also has drug checking on site, so that people, before they inject their drugs, can have them tested so they know what's in them. Now, the kind of information that it provides is not just the nature of the drug. It can also provide information. Testing can also provide information on potency and strength. We know that any drug use is potentially risky, but those risks are significantly increased when there are unknown drugs. If a drug has been missold, so it's not what is expected, or if there are adulterants present, or if there is unknown potency and strength. And one of the things that the Loop found, for example, in their very first festival testing at Secret Garden Party, was that whilst most of the drugs that were brought forward as MDMA ecstasy were actually MDMA ecstasy, the potency ranged from 20 milligrams to over 200 milligrams. So there was a tenfold difference in potency between individual pills. And again, to illustrate the sort of problems that you can face, it's not just unknown potency, it's unknown content. So testing that the Loop did this year, very recently, only a few weeks ago, there was one type of pill called a pharaoh's, it's the shape of a pharaoh's head, because the pills, for whatever reason, tend to be branded with logos or certain faces or characteristics. And there were four different types of drugs. Four entirely different drugs were being sold using the same pharaoh press. So again, drugs are risky, but if you don't know what it is or how strong it is, those risks are inevitably magnified. I can go into more of the detail about the outcomes in terms of the positive results that the Loop's testing has had, or any questions you might have about the other details, and I can also submit some stuff in writing if you want more
details.
Don't worry,
I've got lots more questions to come. So.
Okay.
But I did just wonder on that one point, when something's tested and essentially this is rat poison, it's not going to be great for you. Mm-hmm. How do you convey that? Or the tester, do they have to still give back that drug if, you know, they're like, I'm seriously concerned that this...
Yes. Well, no drugs are returned to the service user. Just to be clear, the drugs are destroyed in the testing process, and any remnants that are left over are either destroyed or passed to the police at the end of the day. So there's the drug testing is then entirely separate and independent from the actual service user, who then just receives the information and nothing in writing either. They receive the information as part of a brief intervention, and they're welcome to bring their friends and peers into those interventions as well. The loop has found that when people are told that what they're having tested is not what they expected, half of them will dispose of the drugs. And in fact, one of the things that the loop do is they offer a drug disposal service. So it's not just the drug that was tested is destroyed. People, say they bought five pills for them and their friends, and they test one and it's not what they're expecting, and it's something potentially very risky, they will often dispose of all of them. So this is one of the benefits of the loop, is that it's not just the individual, it's often the individual's peer group as well. So there's a sort of magnifying effect that helps to actually remove some of these dangerous the particularly dangerous substances of concern from circulation. One of the other things that the loop does is if substances of concern are identified, so for example, at Park Life, when I mentioned the Pharaohs, these Pharaoh pills, there's a drug called Eutalone, which is a fairly obscure cathinone novel psychoactive substances, which has some ecstasy-like effects, was being sold as ecstasy, but it is particularly risky. And it can cause paranoia and psychosis, and it's a major concern. They were able to not only help remove some of those pills from circulation, not only educate the people at the festival that these were in circulation, this was a risk that they needed to be mindful of, they were also able to inform the police and inform the other emergency services that these were in circulation, it was something to look out for. So they can help the preparedness of other services as well. So they provide a secondary tier backup service as well as the information that's given to users. Sorry, I'm not sure whether I answered your question there.
I think you did, and I think we strayed into the next one as well. So you may want to just embellish slightly more, but how could drug checking services help reduce deaths in London?
Well, I mean, it comes back to the point I was making, that there are these different types of drug checking services. So for what you might say, I mean, you've referred to the term recreational, but the sort of nighttime economy. So we're talking about party drug use, mostly stimulants, cocaine, MDMA significantly, but also amphetamines, various cathinone type drugs and NPS are being used. Obviously, you can reduce risk if people know what they are taking. It's not just, young people, they don't have a death wish. They don't want to take unnecessary risks. They do have agency. If you give them the right information, both about what they're taking and about how to manage their drug use and behaviours, they do act on it. No young people want to die. No young people want to end up in an ambulance on the way to hospital. They do use harm reduction information, they do share harm reduction information amongst themselves, but they need to have access to that harm reduction information, and they need to have access to knowledge about what they're taking. So drug testing for that group of people is proven to be very useful. And it's not just from the UK. There are a number of countries that have been doing this for a long time. Austria and the Netherlands have been doing drug checking services for nearly 30 years. So we have a significant body of evidence. In the Netherlands, for example, there are 26 or so centres in towns and cities across the Netherlands where you can drop in, you can get your drugs tested during the week so that you know what they are, and you get this harm reduction information so that when you take them at the weekend, you're much better prepared to manage your risks. And drug-related deaths amongst that population of users, particularly at festivals and in nightclubs, are almost unheard of in the Netherlands. They're a regular feature of, the summer festival season and, unfortunately, clubs more generally in the UK. I mean, I don't need to tell you about these tragedies that seem to come up every few weeks or months, particularly in the summer. Almost never happens in the Netherlands. So we can reduce drug-related deaths for those populations. For the populations of more problematic users, people who are injecting or smoking, Neve's already alluded to this, there are these genuine concerns on the horizon that the heroin market in particular will be contaminated with some of these very potent synthetic opioids like fentanyl and isotretinoin, I'm not even sure how to pronounce it, it's so new, that come along regularly. It's not just fentanyl, there are many different analogues of fentanyl. And fentanyl is 50 to 100 times stronger than heroin and morphine, and carfentanil and some remifentanil. Some of these, they can be thousands of times more strong than heroin. So, a tiny dot of this stuff is still enough to cause an overdose death. Now, we need to be mindful of this. We know how to prevent deaths from these drugs by providing testing services. So that if people have these substances mixed with the heroin, or they've been missold these substances as heroin, they are able to make informed decisions about how they use them. But if we don't have testing services and if we don't have supervised consumption, we can't do those things, or they become a lot more difficult. And we know these things can reduce deaths. We just need to put these services in place.
That was Steve Rolls, a senior policy analyst with Transform. We're listening to a drug policy discussion held recently by the London Assembly. The experts providing testimony are Steve Rolls with Transform, Neve Eastwood from Release, Dr. Prun Bijral with Change Grow Live, and Professor Alex Stevens from the University of Kent. We'll have more in a moment. This is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh.
That brings me to the second mode of civil disobedience. There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Welcome back. Let's hear more from that discussion on drug policy and overdose prevention that the London Assembly held on October 15th. Neve Eastwood is the executive director of Release.
Drug consumption rooms, there's over 100 of these facilities across the world, located in around 60 plus cities. They vary in the way that they operate. Some are highly medicalized. Others are run by peers, so people who have a history of drug use, and it's lesser of a kind of sterile environment. But at their core, what they are facilities for people to come and use their own substances, mainly injecting of opiates, so injecting heroin. Some will have smoking facilities for crack cocaine or cocaine use, but they really are targeting some of the most high-risk drug users and the most marginalised in our communities. The drug consumption happens under supervision. If someone overdoses naloxone, which we've talked about, can be administered. It is also, at its primary core, what it aims to do is to reduce drug-related deaths, reduce overdoses, to reduce infection. I mentioned earlier about the situation with bacterial infections linked to injecting, that research that I referred to. On site, there will be people to provide wound care, so it reduces those infections, it reduces the risk of bloodborne viruses because sterile equipment is being provided, and so people are less likely to share that equipment. So those are the primary aims of the service for the individual. There's a broader aim of reducing sort of so-called public nuisance, so public injecting, etc. So that's the positive for the community. And then there's secondary aims of supporting people into services, whether that be treatment services or broader social services such as housing, etc. So it has a multi-layered approach in terms of positive benefits. To the question of whether it reduces overdose deaths, there is research from Canada. Vancouver opened its first facility in the early noughties, and in the first 2 years of the facility opening, there was a reduction in drug-related deaths. It was estimated 35%. Now, I am going to refer to my colleague Alex Stevens because he is actually the chair of the Drug Consumption Working Group at Drug Science, which we are members of, who has been working proactively on this issue. But the research to date shows that it can reduce overdose deaths. That's both research from Vancouver and from Sydney.
That was Neve Eastwood, Executive Director of Release. Professor Alex Stevens is a professor in criminal justice at the University of Kent.
I'll talk about the legality. I'd also like to come back to the evidence base, if that's all right.
Yeah.
So the Home Office claims, and Home Office ministers have claimed, that it would be illegal to run such a site in the UK. And that is an arguable case. And I think drug consumption rooms in this country would exist in a legal grey area. Because it is obviously true that people who are using these services would be committing the criminal offence of possession of a substance that's controlled under the Misuse of Drugs Act. But as we talked about in relation to drug checking services, that should not necessarily be a barrier to the provision of such a service because those legal issues have been dealt with before in other settings, primarily needle and syringe programmes. So the question then becomes, does the running of a drug consumption room involve other offences? And I would argue that it doesn't, because there is nothing in the Misuse of Drugs Act that prevents a person from running a facility where other people come and use a substance to inject themselves. As long as there is no supply, and as long as that person is not injected by somebody else. So within certain strictures, such as that people bring their own drugs, they're not being provided drugs, and that the staff of the safer injecting facility or drug consumption room are not injecting the people who come, then I do not see that a drug consumption room or supervised injecting facility, whatever you want to call it, would break the Misuse of Drugs Act. So I think that the Home Office's opposition to the running of a drug consumption room is more based in their opposition to the idea of it rather than to the actual laws that are in place. And the fact that Peter Krykant voluntarily set up a drug consumption site in a converted ambulance in Glasgow and was able to run it for several months without being closed down by the police shows that it is possible within the British legal framework to run such a facility. Shall I carry on with the evidence base, or do you want to talk about the legality more?
No, if you could, go to the evidence base.
So the evidence base for drug consumption rooms is primarily built on the services that exist in Australia and Canada, even though there are at least 10 other countries that also provide drug consumption rooms. In Sydney and in Melbourne, and in Vancouver and various other Canadian cities, there have been multiple studies that show the effects of drug consumption rooms in reducing deaths, reducing bloodborne virus transmission, including HIV, in encouraging people into other treatment services, and without doing what is often feared they will do, which is what's known as the honeypot effect. So people argue in opposition to drug consumption rooms that they would attract people who use drugs to a certain area and that therefore public nuisance and crime would increase in that area. In the studies that have been done in these cities, that has been shown not to happen. And indeed, the studies, particularly in the Australian context, have shown a reduction in public nuisance. For example, in the littering of used injecting paraphernalia close to the site, as well as a reduction in the use of ambulance services in those areas, and therefore reductions in costs because of the reduced propensity of overdose of drug use to lead to overdose and death. And so it's also the case that you would see substantial cost savings associated both in the short term from reducing drug-related emergencies, but also in the long term from reducing the very expensive care that people will need if they contract HIV and viral hepatitis. Now, there is a limitation to this research. Similarly to naloxone, it's not possible to do randomized controlled trials on drug consumption rooms. The nature of the intervention means that it's practically impossible to randomize it and test the causal effect of drug consumption rooms versus no drug consumption rooms. So the purists amongst the academic community would say that the evidence is not as strong as you might like it to be, that drug consumption rooms reduce deaths. But on the other side, we have, you know, a clear mechanism by which they would reduce deaths. We have evidence of the place that have introduced them having seen reductions in death. And so we would expect that to occur in a British context. But the third point I would like to make is that the evidence suggests that the effect of a drug consumption room is highly localized to the immediate vicinity of where you set up the service. And so people who use heroin or crack would normally tend to be looking for somewhere to use that drug very close to where they bought it or where they were at the time. And so the effect, for example, in Vancouver in reducing deaths was localized to just a few city blocks. And so drug consumption rooms are best located in hot spots of injecting drug use and overdose. Now, the question is, for me, in the London context, is the London drug market still so heavily localized and concentrated that you would find a place that would make sense to have a fixed location where you have a drug consumption room? And I think there is a mapping job to be done across London, because the drug market in London has changed substantially over the last 10 to 15 years because of the way that drug supply has changed. I'm not aware of, I'm aware that there are less places in London where people congregate to buy and use drugs than there used to be 15, 20 years ago. So if you ask me now, I wouldn't know where to put a drug consumption room in London. So I would advise that there be a mapping exercise to find out where these problems are clustered and whether it would make sense to have a fixed location or perhaps a mobile service that meets the needs of the people who are using drugs near where they are buying and using currently.
That was Professor Alex Stevens, Professor in Criminal Justice, University of Kent. That was from a discussion on overdose prevention and drug policy reform that was held by the London Assembly on October 15th. The experts providing testimony were Steve Rolls from Transform, Neve Eastwood from Release, Dr. Prunbij Rall from Change Grow Live, and Professor Alex Stevens from the University of Kent. And that's it. Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Thank you to everyone out there fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. And thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. Theme music for Free Culture Radio was composed and performed by Tom Nickel and Four Dimensional Nightmare. Find Free Culture Radio on the web at kboo.fm/freeculture. There's a link there to subscribe to the Free Culture podcast. Free Culture Radio is on Facebook at facebook.com/kboofreecultureradio. Please give it a like. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long.